listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features all things book-related, especially interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Sharon Guskin, whose debut novel, The Forgetting Time, comes out tomorrow from Flatiron Books. The Forgetting Time has just been made People Magazine's Book of the Week, and it's on the BBC's list of 10 books to read in the month of February. In addition to writing fiction, Sharon Guskin has worked as a writer and producer of award-winning documentary films, including Stolen and On Meditation. She began exploring the ideas examined in The Forgetting Time when she worked at a refugee camp in Thailand as a young woman, and later served as a hospice volunteer soon after the birth of her first child. She's been a fellow at YADO, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Blue Mountain Center, and Ragdale, and has degrees from Yale University and the Columbia University School of the Arts. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two sons. Here's a little more information about The Forgetting Time. Noah is 4 and wants to go home. The only trouble is he's already home. Nothing with Noah is easy, as his mother Janie knows. He's terrified of water, so getting him to take a bath is a battle Janie often can't bring herself to fight. He has nightmares so scary that even she is frightened. People say he'll grow out of it, but the opposite seems to be happening. Things are getting worse. When Noah's preschool calls Janie at work one day and says they need to talk about Noah, not later, now, life as Janie knows it stops. For Jerome Anderson, life as he's known it has already stopped. A deadly diagnosis forces him to acknowledge he may soon be approaching the end. His first thought, I'm not finished yet. Once a shining young star in academia, a professor of psychiatry, he seemingly threw it all away to chase a mystery. He lost the respect of his peers, but he didn't care. He spent his life looking for an explanation. When Janie brings 4-year-old Noah to him, desperate for help, Anderson realizes that Noah might hold the key to his research. This boy may well be his last chance at redemption. Soon, Noah, Janie, and Anderson will find themselves knocking on the door of a woman none of them have ever met before. Behind that door waits the answers to all of their questions. But is that what they truly want? When I spoke with Sharon Guskin, I began by asking her to read from the opening of her novel. At this point in the narrative, Janie has not yet become a mother. Alone and rather lonely in the world, she is on a vacation to celebrate a birthday. From there, I will let the excerpt speak for itself. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Sharon Guskin.
On the eve of her 39th birthday, on the bleakest day of the worst in February in memory, Janie made what would turn out to be the pivotal decision of her life. She decided to take a vacation. Trinidad was not the best choice, maybe. If she was going that far, she really should have gone to Tobago or Venezuela. But she liked the sound of it, Trin-id-dad, its musicality like a promise. She bought the cheapest ticket she could find and got there just as the carnival revelers were all going home, the gutters filled with the most beautiful trash she'd ever seen. The streets were empty, people sleeping off the party. The cleanup crew moved slowly in a contented underwater shuffle. She'd scooped up handfuls of confetti and stray glittery feathers and plastic jewelry from the curb and stuffed them in her pockets, trying to absorb frivolity by osmosis. There was a wedding going on in her hotel, an American woman marrying a Trinidadian man, and most of the guests were there for it. She watched them circling one another, the aunts and uncles and cousins wilting in the heat, their cheeks daubed with a smear of red sunburn that made them seem happier than they were, and the bemused Trinnies, who were always in groups, laughing and talking in fast Trinny slang. The humidity was intense, but the warm embrace of the sea made up for it, like a consolation prize for the loveless. The beach was exactly like its picture, all palm trees and blue water and green hills, with sandflies that brushed and stung your ankles to remind you that it was real, and little shacks planted here and there that sold bacon shark, deep-fried shark in a pocket of fried fresh dough that tasted better than anything she'd ever eaten. The hotel shower sometimes had hot water and sometimes cold, and sometimes it had no water at all.
Great. Thank you very much for reading that to me, or for the show. I really loved that you started at this point in the book, because it really precedes the bulk of the plot. This is before her son Noah is born and she is on vacation. How did you decide to start right there?
I think, first of all, actually, because the book eventually ends up going kind of a little far out in terms of many different kinds of places and experiences, I really wanted to ground the reader in something that I thought everyone can relate to. And just kind of the sensual experience of being on vacation. And also just kind of create a sense of this woman at this point of her life, and her solitude as well.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a big part of the book, is sort of our loneliness and the way that we're connected to others. And so to start with the main character, or one of the main characters, in a very solitary place, seemed right to me.
And there were two things that really stood out to me about the opening of the book. One was the wonderful vivid detail that you offer us about Trinidad and about her experience of it. You know, it's very clear that she is absolutely just soaking in all of this vacation. You know, she wants it to count. It feels like she needs it pretty badly.
Yes, it's February in New York can be tough sometimes.
Right. Well, so that kind of leads into my second thing that I noticed, was that in a sense, the book opens almost in a series of negatives. It's the eve of her birthday, not the day. It's the bleakest day. It's the worst February. Trinidad is not the best. She gets the cheapest ticket. The gutters are filled with beautiful trash, and the streets are empty. And I was really interested in the fact that all of these things kind of line up. And even though she's in a place that she's very excited to be on vacation and it's going to be a positive experience, it was interesting that it starts out with all of these kind of not negatives, but maybe it underlines the emptiness that she's feeling. And I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yes, I think, again, it's kind of summing up not only her physical isolation, she goes by herself on her, you know, for her birthday, but her, you know, her state of mind, her kind of isolated state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a woman who really feels entirely alone and kind of disconnected. Her mother is no longer living. You know, she has other people in her life, but she's not feeling powerful connection with them. And I think it's just that state of mind of, oh, I missed the party. You know, she came too late for the party.
Right.
You know, and so I think because, you know, to a large part, you know, this character just changes in enormous ways through the course of the book. It seemed like a good place to begin, and it seemed like it just seemed to make sense to me. It's interesting. I never thought of it quite that way, although obviously when you're writing these things, like, it's sort of percolating somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was definitely important to me somehow that she missed the carnival. Like, it's like she's feeling kind of sorry for herself, but she knows she shouldn't feel too sorry for herself. So she's just kind of in that state. And there's a kind of hopefully subterranean longing that's coming through of, like, wait, I want something. I want the carnival.
Right.
I want connection. And so to kind of have both those things at once, so it's not sort of a bleak experience for the reader, but just this experience of kind of wanting but not knowing how to do it.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Now, some of the descriptions of the book have used the expression, the forgetting time is a hypnotic meditation on what we know and the glory of all that we don't. I think that's a good way of putting it. You know, what we know is sort of, there's a lot about
connection and about relationships, and but then there's a lot about what we don't know, what happens to us after we die, what, you know, where do we come from, let's say. So I'm sure you're going to be asked in a lot of interviews if you believe in past lives, which this book deals with. And to some extent, I'm curious about that. But I also am maybe even more curious to know if you feel that authors need to believe in the premise that builds into their fiction in a book like your novel.
I don't think you need to believe in the premise. I certainly started out writing this book kind of really mostly curious. You know, I had heard about these cases. Ian Stevenson is a real professor and psychiatrist, and Jim Tucker, who took over the work from him at University of Virginia, and there were these 3,000 cases they researched about these children that seemed to remember previous lifetimes, and I read about the cases, and they were, you know, like amazing, mind-boggling cases to me, and I was just fascinated by them.
Right.
And so that was the magnet for me. It's like, these cases are fascinating. Like, wow, what would it be like to kind of be one of these, you know, like, because there are these families where the child wanted to be with a different family. And
right.
I thought, oh, what would that be like to be in that situation? And so I was just deeply, deeply curious in the cases themselves, in the implications of the cases. And so I think that's really the most important thing. I don't think, from my sense, I mean, I can go into it if you like or not, but my own personal beliefs sort of changed over the course of writing this book, but I think the most important thing has, to me, about it has stayed the same, which is just the questions we ask.
Yes.
And I started asking this question. I read the cases and I asked the question, what if this is true?
Right.
Like, what would that mean for characters, for me as a mother, as a person, you know, as somebody who does things in the world? What if it's true that we come back?
Yeah.
And so I really think that it's just very important to feel kind of, I took my first writing teacher ever. I was very lucky to have Peter Matheson teach me a class, and he used to talk about the magnet that draws you through a book. Like, this should be a magnet drawing you through,
right.
You know. And I think that for me, like, my intention was always really clear, is to ask that question and to hope that other people might have an enjoyable experience of the book, but also start asking that question, what does it mean? What if it's true? Like, you know, it's just, to me, that's the most fascinating thing at all. This is a pretty important question
yeah.
to ask, and it's pretty interesting, too.
Yeah. Now, I want to know how you first encountered the work of Drs. Stevenson and Tucker. How did you first come across that?
Well, somebody had was cleaning up their garage, and they handed me this book called Old Souls, which is a book by Tom Schroeder, who's a Washington Post reporter. And he basically, it's a nonfiction book, he basically follows Dr. Stevenson around and sort of narrates some of his cases. And so I was given that book at a moment when I was both, like, volunteering at a hospice, and I had little kids, and so I was kind of, all these ideas were kind of, like, starting to percolate, and I was starting to think about it all anyway, and somebody just said, oh, I think you'd like this book. So I read the book, and again, the cases just drew me, and then I read Jim Tucker's book, Life Before Life, and was kind of blown away by how reasonable he was.
Right.
Like, I've gotten to know him, and he is very reasonable, and it's like, oh, this guy is not, you know, he's not some quack. He knows what he's talking about, and he's very carefully, cautiously laying out his description of these cases and what they could mean and how we can explain them. So anyway, that's it was really through the books that I was drawn to it, and then of course once I started opening that door to the fact that kids say things that indicate previous lives, then suddenly all around me I'm hearing stories. So
right.
But I didn't have, you know, it would be fascinating if one of my kids had said something like that, but actually that's not what happened.
But fascinating, but a little disturbing too.
Yeah, it wouldn't, you know, it's difficult for some people, obviously.
I'm sure, so. Yeah. Now, you have a character in the book who is a doctor along the same lines as these real-life people whose work inspired you, and his name is Anderson. And he is suffering from a primary progressive aphasia, PPA. So I thought I would ask you a little bit about the research that you did while you were working on the book, both the research into the works of Drs. Stevenson and Tucker, and also into this disease, and how you came to decide that this was going to be another part of the plot, that this character is suffering from this disease that, in fact, will rob him of language eventually.
Well, I think, I guess to answer the first part of the question, there's a lot of research related to aphasia. I did a lot of research online and reading various articles, both sort of medical pieces, and, you know, Oliver Sacks wrote an essay about some people with aphasia. And I also have a family member, actually, who has this kind of semantic aphasia. So, sadly, I have kind of a experience of how frustrating and complicated and difficult it is when you start to lose language, but sort of maintain your mental capacity. So in terms of that particular research, it was almost more painful than difficult, just because I was finding out more dire things about this illness that was afflicting a sort of a relative. And I think, you know, obviously, since the book has to do with children who remember things that most children don't remember, you know, I just became consumed with the idea of memory and what we remember and how we remember. And I think just this idea of someone losing that foothold, that the language itself, would bring another kind of perspective on memory, and also just sort of cause us to think a little more about, you know what I mean, about who we are, how much of our identity is our memories, and our, you know, so, and our ability to articulate them. So, I mean, that sounds very intellectual. It was also kind of a visceral feeling about Anderson, that I wanted him, you know, I wanted him to be pretty desperate, actually, and I wanted you to really feel for him. And so there was a part of me that just kind of thought, yeah, he's struggling. He's losing this battle.
Right.
And that might just create more sympathy in the readers, because he's pretty driven, and sometimes he can be a little manipulative. And just for me, I love the character, and I wanted others to sort of be able to relate to him. So so that's how that kind of came about. And in terms of research, on, you know, general research, I mean, it got to be a little overwhelming after a while, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there on reincarnation. there's a lot of books. So at first I was like, oh, I've got to read this. And finally I just kind of started narrowing my focus to Stevenson's books. A number of his books tend to be more academic, actually, and there's one called Reincarnation and Biology that I didn't make through. It's like 1,000 pages, and it's these fascinating, you know, descriptions of how birthmarks and birth defects map out to the modes of death from previous lifetimes, which is really fascinating, but it's also really, really sort of particular in the book. And I also met with Jim Tucker a number of times, and he's been super generous, just sort of describing different cases, describing their methodology. University of Virginia has this institute called the Division of Perceptual Studies, which is fascinating in and of itself, where Jim Tucker, you know, investigates children who seem to remember previous lifetimes. There's a professor who investigates near-death experiences, and they have a library and some artifacts that Stevenson collected. So that was a lot of fun to go to Virginia and look into all that stuff. And then, you know, people have told me a lot of their personal stories about their children,
Yeah.
Not, you know, I mean, just sort of almost just anecdotal. I mean, just people that I met ended up telling me a lot of stories. So that kind of worked its way into the book as well.
I bet you're about to hear a lot more of them.
Well, I'd love to hear them. I'm going to say, I'll just say to your listeners, like, my website is theforgettingtime.com, and anyone who has a story, please email me and let me know if you want me to keep it anonymous, because I'm starting to collect them. I think they're fascinating. I think people would be interested in them.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry, I had to do a little plug for my
story
collecting.
No, that's great. So let's see. I wanted to ask you of your experience of writing a character, a main character, pretty main character, although not a point of view character, but anyway, an important character who is a child. What did you find were the specific challenges of, because I think that carries its own set of challenges. Do you feel that way too?
I do, and in fact, at various points I had experimented with having the voice of the child, Noah, who's sort of four, and in the book.
Right.
And I have to say, I wasn't convinced by my efforts enough to do it. So I do find it challenging. I mean, I think, for instance, Room is a version, you know, is a book in which the author brilliantly conveys the perspective of a 5-year-old child.
Yeah.
So it definitely can be done. But I just found, I mean, for me in this case, because there's so much that he knows, kind of, he knows as a child knows it, but I don't want the reader to know it yet. So there was just so much, there's so many complications related to just information
right.
when I was going into his perspective that it just became too much. And so he became a character, but who was perceived, you know, entirely by the others.
Mm-hmm.
In his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two sons, neither of which is little anymore. They're 11 and 13. But I kind of remember what it was like when they were younger.
Yeah.
And I stole some of their lines. Because they're funnier than I am. So I thought, okay, the kid could be funny sometimes. So that was helpful too. But I definitely agree with you. I think, you know, I just, at a certain point, I made my peace with it, that the book was not going to have Noah's perspective. But I'm glad that I tried, because I think I needed to know that it wasn't going to work.
Right.
So that's just one of those alleys you go down, and then you're like, okay, now I understand. Wrong alley. Go back out.
Right, well, I think that's really important when you're writing, is to... you know, you have to try all kinds of different things to present the story in the best way.
Yeah, I think you can trust yourself to some degree to just give it a shot and then feel your way through it. And at some level, intuitively, you know if it's working, if that voice
right.
is working or not. And, you know, interestingly, there were voices that are very far from me. I mean, there's one character who's, you know, a 15-year-old kid. And that didn't seem to be a problem. And it wasn't because of my kids. It just sort of came out, you know, Charlie was Charlie. And I was like, okay, I'm going with it.
Yeah.
And I was happy to. But, you know, then other times you just kind of try to figure out how you can get back to the ones that work for you, you know,
right. Yeah.
and definitely not linger on the characters that you feel aren't quite revealing themselves. Although, honestly, with the character of Janie, I went through multiple drafts with that character and had to kind of move her very, very consciously away from myself and my life, because
mm-hmm.
she was too much of a writer. She was too trapped in her, she was in her head all the time, as
yeah.
she can be. And it wasn't very interesting for a character. So I had to kind of really, okay, nope, she's not a filmmaker, she's not a photographer, she's an architect, she's making things. Like, okay, that's very different, you know? So I
yeah.
had to really consciously kind of place her differently in order to be able to work with her better.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and it wasn't actually a question I was planning to ask you, but now that it's come up, I think sometimes writing characters who are, at least on the page, starting to look a lot like ourselves, the authors, those characters sometimes can end up coming out a little bit flat, and I don't know exactly why that is, but it's something that I've noticed in my own work anyway. You know, and sometimes I really have to work hard to change a person who seems to be a lot like me. Maybe you make assumptions that don't end up on the page. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm talking about?
It does. I've thought about it too, because I have the same issue, that the characters that are the most, you know, like me and sort of on paper anyway,
right,
are the most difficult ones to crack and to sort of have them be appealing. You know, for some reason, Janie was, her name was Sarah, my name is Sharon. I was like, I moved it away from the S's, you know. I mean, literally, it was like, she wasn't likable. And I don't necessarily like, oh, I don't think I'm likable. But somehow, I couldn't get, I was too close. And
yeah,
it just kept sort of, it's almost like it, you know, like there's an undertow or something, and you keep kind of getting swept back or swept out or something. It's not,
right.
I'm sorry, my metaphor is not quite working, but it's not, it feels like you're getting pulled into some kind of abyss when you're too close to who you seem to be.
Yeah.
And maybe part of it is because we're writing to empathize, to put, you know, to be other people. So,
yeah.
Why get too close, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things about Janie's personality, which may parallel a little bit the unlikability that you mentioned, is she really, really, really has to advocate for Noah and herself. She needs to protect them, and she needs to protect herself from being sucked into something that she's not sure what she thinks about. And so she can't just always be the easygoing character who's going to go along with Anderson, who we do have empathy for, because partly because of his aphasia and partly because he's at the end of his career and you want to see him succeed with his work. And so she sometimes has to be the person who is an obstacle to him. And I wondered how that was for you. Did you ever find it difficult to have Janie and Anderson maybe not on the same page and have to create complications between them when all we really want is for everything to work out?
Huh, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's right, that she is positioned as a kind of obstacle. I think, I mean, to some degree it had to do with the fact that it is a book that ultimately is about, you know, past lives, and mm-hmm. I don't assume that readers coming to this book are like, oh yeah, we all have past lives, you know. So in some ways, Janie was also a stand-in for everybody, you know.
Right.
She's skeptical, and she needed to be skeptical. Not as a straw person skeptical, but truly skeptical. I mean, and actually, the wonderful thing about Stevenson and Tucker, they're scientists, and they're skeptical too. They don't believe something because they want to. They investigate things. And
right. Well, there's a line in the book which I loved, which was Anderson says to Janie at one point, "We have to think like the skeptics think." That was a great moment, because I just sort of, that felt very real to me. Just like that was his scientists coming out and saying, "No, no, no, we have to think about the skeptics and their perspective."
And that's why they're so convincing, Stevenson and Tucker's work, really, because they are really, you know, if there's a reason to discount it, a story, let's say a child says, I was this person in this place, and I did these things, as they do in these cases, you know, like somebody, oh, I lived next to the temple, and I sold two kinds of incense, and then I was hit by a truck, and I died, you know, and the kid will say this, and they'll find, like, a real person who sold those two kinds of incense and lived next to the temple, was hit by a truck, and it's very compelling. But Stevenson and Tucker will ask everybody in the village of the child, all the parents. They want to make sure that there's nobody who, yeah, oh yeah, that was my uncle. I might have mentioned that, you know,
mm-hmm.
to that kid. I don't know if I'm being clear, but, you know, so basically
yes.
It's really, there's a lot of meticulous sort of attention to these details, to really be conscientious, because of what they're doing is so you know, potentially explosive in a way, and they're trying to prove scientifically that consciousness continues after death, and so they feel, you know, they have to be as careful as possible, and so there's in that way there's skepticism on both sides. But of course, you know, Anderson is totally on this track, and so So Janie is really just a person who's just kind of like many of us, certainly like I was before I started working on this, of, yeah, I don't know, like maybe, right. But I don't right. know.
Right. And there's an event that I won't go into because I don't want to give anything away, but there's an event that kind of makes her step back and say, wait a minute, you know, is this going too fast? Is this going out of control? Is this good for my son? You know, and I thought she was a truly believable character as just like a caring mother who's trying to work out what is going on, this thing that I don't understand, and I have to be taking care of my son. So I thought that all of that came together really well in her character.
Thanks.
So, again, without giving anything away, I want to ask you about a point of view character named Denise, who enters the narrative something like halfway into the book, and I think it must be hard to introduce a new point of view at this point, but it works really well in The Forgetting Time. I wonder if you have any thoughts about this.
You know, it was something that I really struggled with. I tried to put Denise in earlier. But it didn't, you know, for narrative reasons, it didn't work. And I mean, I really love that character. In fact, she might be my favorite character in the book. So it's a little difficult as an author to wait so long before you bring her in. And I think this is something I really worked a lot, with my editor, Amy Einhorn, who's just very aware of don't let the reader get ahead of you. Don't let the reader get ahead of you. And so when I put in Denise earlier, it's a little hard to talk about it without giving too much away.
Right.
But basically, just the fact of Denise being there told the reader a lot about where the story was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it was more important to keep to sort of have the reader be following Janie on her journey through the story and not feel like, okay, I get it. Let's get there already, you know?
Right.
So that was part of it, but it's still a little painful to me that you have to wait so long to get to Denise.
Okay, and one other sort of structural thing that happens in the book, which I found really interesting, is between certain chapters, you reproduce what seem to be actual case studies from the work of people like Dr. Tucker and a person named K.S. Rawat. These are case studies, I assume, from your research. I wonder if you can talk about including these and the way that you did so, the frequency within the narrative, and also if you ever thought of mixing in some of Anderson's fictionalized case studies in the same way, or, you know, how you made that choice.
Well, actually, they are, it's not as clear as I'd like it to be, but most of them are from, there are Jim Tucker's cases, or there are Anderson's, or there were Stevenson's cases that Tucker included in a book of his called Life Before Life. So,
right.
So they are real cases.
Yeah.
And I did think about sort of making up cases, but I just, to be honest, I find these real cases are just so interesting and incredible, and in a way, I feel like the real cases are way more fascinating than the case I made up for the book. I mean, I hope people enjoy the book, of course, but I just felt like, you know what, people might want to read these cases, might want to just a taste of them, and so. So I, you know, again, it was sort of a back and forth with my editor, who was kind of. Really excited about the idea of including pieces of the nonfiction within the novel,
right.
But we also didn't want to pull people too far out of the book, and that's why perhaps it's slightly confusing where they're coming from, because we didn't want to sort of say, okay, now we're not in the novel anymore, and here's, you know, and this is Dr. Jim Tucker, and here's his case. So they kind of just show up. Through, you know, starting again at a certain point, because I couldn't start them from the beginning or would be giving too much away.
Right.
You know, I hope people are interested in them. I shuffled them around a lot. I mean, there were other cases in there. I kept playing, you know, as one does when you have something like this going on in a narrative where you have, you know, other bits. I kept moving them around and moving them around. And, you know, if I didn't have to turn the book in, I'd probably still be moving them around. Trying to figure out, like, what case is too long for its point in the, you know, is it going to drag the momentum? but maybe we need a break here anyway from all the intensity, you know, mm-hmm. and just kind of keeping, you know, you want to have sort of a musical sense of what should come next.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's also the practicality of, like, how long it should be and all these other issues. So
yeah.
And which ones are the most compelling and that sort of thing.
I thought that they went very far to taking me as a reader by the hand and helping me step into this world, some of which was fictional and some of which is just asking me to stretch my normal belief system. And I thought that they were great. I really enjoyed that they were in there. Now, you just mentioned intensity, and I have a question about that. So, at a couple of points in the book, you include some very intense and revealing scenes about Noah and about his declarations of a past life. And I wondered, as a writer, did you find those sorts of scenes challenging to get right after so there's a certain amount of build-up that leads to certain scenes that are kind of epiphanies. Were those hard to get right, given all the build-up that led to them?
I think, yes, in the sense that I really had to take a lot of care with them, you know. And, I mean, I like intense scenes in general, you know, that's mm-hmm. kind of fun. You're working up to it and like, oh, great, now everything gets to explode. But then when you're actually, you know, the actual explosion has to be like frame by frame or something, you know, very
right.
image by image. And there's so many details that go into these moments. And often these moments tend to have a number of people in them, at least some of them did. So there were certain scenes that I rewrote many, many, many times because I needed to sort of, you know, I would write it and then, oh, I forgot about this other person. All this stuff is going down. This other person's in the scene and not responding, you know. Any of the other person's, you know, just like, just practically speaking to sort of get the temperature of the room for everybody in the room, you know.
Right.
Was, and also not to tip it over into kind of total melodrama.
Right.
So how far do I let myself go here before it's just way too much? So
right.
I think those scenes did take the most care in a way, in terms of just making sure and sort of, and sometimes, you know, I go back to a scene in which there's a lot of, you know, almost shouting in a way, a lot of intensity from all the characters, and suddenly realize, oh, this character, it's more powerful. It's almost like it's sort of like an acting exercise. If you just sense that they're holding back all the emotion, you know,
right.
That they're not expressing it, and you're just using the details, the physical details, to show that this person is really feeling overwhelmed or feeling, you know, a lot.
Right.
So again, it's just kind of like teaching myself how to write drama.
Now you make the decision, the choice, to actually show us a little of Anderson's past. There's a whole storyline around Anderson that we haven't really talked about, which has to do with his wife. But then there's also the past of his research, and at one point you have the character recalling an experience of being in Thailand in 1977, and he is with a friend from college named Bobby Angsley. They're on the veranda of his hotel, and they're talking about this work that will eventually become very important to Anderson. From where he sits on this veranda, Anderson can see a dog trying to cross a river. The currents are strong, and there's some question as to whether the dog is going to be able to make it. I found that a really interesting moment. I was just riveted. I wondered why that dog was in that scene, and if you remember writing that, do you have thoughts about what that dog does for that particular scene?
Huh. Oh, that's such an interesting question. I like the dog too. I think that, you know, it plays out in some practical, you know, again, sort of mechanical way, in terms of you have these two characters, they haven't seen each other a long time, there's a lot just going on between them, there's a business with they're having tea, and having Anderson focus on something else that was sort of a little story within the scene, about whether the dog's going to make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, like, had a lot of intensity in it. The dog might drown. So you kind of, you know, again, so that the characters aren't, like, exploding at each other, but it sort of was a way to feel the tension and the kind of, the sort of deep loss that Anderson's feeling, without going into it in the moment. You sort of have this other event to focus on that is carrying a little bit of the emotion.
Yes.
At the same time, and I'm not even sure I can fully articulate this, but there was something thematically that felt right to me. I mean, he can see from sitting there, I think, the sun shining off, you know, this beautiful Bangkok temple, you know, and sending color into the sky. And then at mm-hmm. the same time, here's this mangy dog that might drown, and he might not drown. And there was something that touched on how we live today
yeah.
in that juxtaposition.
Right, right. And also some of the past life subjects, I'll call them subjects, that he's going to come across in his career, and the nature of their lives, and the intensity with which they live. You know, there's more danger in certain countries just on a day-to-day basis.
Sure, yeah.
So
I
don't know.
A certain amount of drowning, actually, that, you know,
yes.
that happens. And so
yeah.
sort of there's a watery theme that's there that I kind of touched on as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. While we're talking about Bobby Angsley, I have a question that's maybe not as important a question, but it matters to me as a writer. I wondered if we can talk about character names. How important is it for you as a writer to get the name just right? You know, Bobby Angsley is a wealthy man. On one level, he's kind of coasting on, I think, some family money. On another level, this stuff really does matter to him. And his name was perfect. So I just wondered how hard you worked to find the right name for each character.
With that name, it just, you know, some names just show up and you don't know where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to, like, search and make sure it's not somebody
yeah, yeah.
in the world, unless it's a very common name. So I think, you know, it's a combination. You're sort of playing around practically, and then there's this intuition of, like, is that the person? Is that their name? You know?
Right.
And
right,
people
right.
have asked me, why Janie? You know, Janie, J-A-N-I-E. It's a funny name for a grown woman. I can't tell you why. I just...
It's
you know,
just her
I
name.
Liked her better when she was Janie. The Sarah woman, I'm glad to be done with her. She wasn't working. But Janie I like. And, you know, with Anderson, I suppose sentimentally named his first name after I had a kind of a mentor whose name was Jerome Badanis, who's a beautiful writer and writing teacher and mentor, and who died many, many years ago. And I always just, I don't know, when I was writing this, I was thinking about Jerry, and so I gave him the name Jerome, and then I tried to take it back at a certain point. I said, well, this character wouldn't have that name Jerome, and I couldn't do it. I was like, nope, it was too late to change his name. In the case of Sarah, she never really embodied her name. I was happy to get rid of it. In the case of mm-hmm. Jerry, I was stuck with it. It was like, that's his name. So I think, and then there's a lot of, like, really secondary characters that just come on briefly and off briefly, and that was, in a way, it was almost kind of a funny process where I suddenly thought, oh, I know somebody with that last name, and that character's not the nicest, and I better change that, and asking
yeah.
people, you know, and then sometimes you stick in some, you know, elementary school principal that you vaguely remember, it's a convincing name, you know, and then the character's pleasant enough that no one's going to mind, and...
Right.
So, but, you know, I don't have any kind of Dickensian flair for coming up with
okay.
wild names or anything.
All right, I was going to ask you if you have read any books lately that you particularly enjoyed or would want to share the titles of.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, there are a couple books that I've read recently by authors who I think actually are brilliant and might not be as known
mm-hmm.
by the world. There's a book called A Free State by Tom Piazza, who's
oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know, he's written a lot of, City of Refuge, which is about Hurricane Katrina. It's a novel.
Is he a jazz pianist?
He writes about jazz. He wrote Tremé. He wrote a book called Why New Orleans Matters. And he's a really tremendous fiction writer. And he's really kind of mostly known for some reason in the South. I just think that's kind of how, even though there's no reason for that. He doesn't only write about, you know, New Orleans. And he wrote this new book called A Free State, which came out, I think, in September, which is about, it's historical, though it doesn't feel like a historical novel. It feels kind of really vibrant and current. And it's about this escaped slave who ends up in Philadelphia, and he ends up joining a white minstrel group in order to sort of, because he's musically talented, and in order to hide and also play his music, which is freedom to him, he ends up sort of putting on burnt cork on his face and joining this white minstrel group. And it's really fascinating and kind of, you know, it's a very thrilling read, but there's so many ideas, and the writing is so beautiful, and there's so many ideas about freedom and about, you know, these white musicians who suddenly feel liberated when they're playing these kind of wildly racist, you know, versions of black people in the South at that, you know, on plantations, and just the kind of juxtaposition and the ironies. It's really, like, a lot to think about, and also just really fun to read. So I really enjoyed that.
Okay.
And I started it. I haven't quite finished, partly because it's so delicious that I don't want to finish this book. It's called Ways to Disappear, and it's coming out February 9th. And I've just got to know the book because we're on some of these lists. You know, when you have a book coming out, there's your
sure
and best list or whatever. It's by Idra Novi, and it's about this Brazilian author who goes up into a tree and disappears, and this her translator from the U.S. who comes to find her. But you can't, it's one of these books you can't even quite describe. It's just, like, unbelievably fun and funny and also smart and about a million things, like about writing. It's about writing. It's about translating. It's about creativity. There's, you know, it's hot. You know, it's set in Brazil. I mean, hot in both ways, you know.
Is it
like so fun?
Is it super bizarre? It sounds like a Murakami plot or something.
It's not. It's, you know, it's one of these uncharacterizable books.
Okay.
It's not super bizarre. It's a little bit of magical realism in it. It's very, very readable, though. It's really short chapters. It's really, and it's really engaging, and you really care about the characters. But it takes you to some out there places, and she just. It's one of these people, and I think it's true, both of Idra Novi and Tom Piazza, they're like the really, really good writers, and yet you don't feel like it's medicine, you know, you don't feel like you're bogged down in their language and their ideas, they're taking you on these rides. So.
Right, so I know your book comes out on Tuesday, so you're pretty busy right now, you probably don't have time to write anything for a little while, but do you know what your next project will be?
I do. I mean, I've been wanting to have a project for a long time because it is very distracting when a book is coming out. And I think most writers that I know find it really grounding to already be into the next one.
Yeah.
And it also makes you less sort of buffeted by whatever wind is coming your way. Oh, so-and-so, you know, somebody on Goodreads just gave me a bad review or whatever. You know, it's just, you just... you're just like, okay, my mind is focused on this new story. So I've tried out various things, and now I think I found, I just started, but it's very early days. I started on something that I think is interesting to me. And interestingly, it has, or at least to me, it has a character from The Forgetting Time in it, although it's not one of the major characters.
Oh, interesting.
And it's not about reincarnation, but, I mean, maybe for me that was the bridge, and... He could, you know, the character could very well end up getting cut.
Okay. Oh, can I ask who it is?
I'll just keep it to myself
for
right now.
All right, that's fine. I just have one last question for you. Having asked you about that scene in Thailand, I am curious how much you use backstory or flashback when you're writing, and if you have any advice for people who are listening who are writers about the correct balance of backstory or flashback within a narrative.
Well, I think there are, you know, those things, they're interesting, they're hard, it's hard to balance, and I think you really need to work at it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love going back, especially with this, because I got to go to so many places, like India and Thailand, and I loved creating all of these backstories about my characters, and I kind of fell in love with them a little too much.
Okay.
And so at one point I had, you know, it was not only the Thailand scene chapter, but there were a few chapters about, you know, Anderson and Ainsley in college, and mm-hmm. like just a number of scenes that I really, I loved writing them, and I thought they shone some light, you know, on these characters. And so I was very attached to them, actually, and then at a certain point I started handing the book out to friends, my readers, you know, and
right.
just to see, like, how's it going? And every single one of them, so interesting, they're like, oh, yeah, I love it. You know, I'll get back to it soon, I just had a lot of stuff going on. And every single one said, it's not the book, I'm just really busy with this or that, or, you know, but then I started asking them, oh, okay, that's fine, where'd you stop reading?
Yeah.
And every single one had stopped right before my, you know, 70-page flashback. Every single one. So it's like, okay, even though I love it, it's sort of raising a flag of, you can stop reading now, we're just going back in time.
Yeah.
So I actually removed it from that place in the narrative and moved it later at a place where I thought they were already going to be so hooked they could take a breather and go back. And I ended up cutting it by quite a bit, which was painful, you know, but there's that, you know, phrase of, you have to kill your darlings, and for me it was definitely true that I, you know, at one point had envisioned, you know, a much longer book with all that stuff in there. But in the end, I was convinced that it wasn't the thing that best served the book.
Right.
And I didn't want everyone to say, oh, yeah, I liked it, but I had to stop because, like, you know, I mean, and these days people. Well, you know, there's a lot of distractions out there, and you really want to be very careful with this gift of people's attention.
Yes.
Because it's so rare.
That is so true. Yeah, and actually that, I think, relates to something we were talking about earlier when we were talking about Anderson's aphasia and the research that you did. And I think sometimes when you do research for a novel, you can become entranced by the information that you're uncovering and want to include all of it. And I think that's another way that maybe we'll lose a reader if you put too much of that in.
Absolutely. I mean, I found in the novel Euphoria, which I'm
yes.
sure you're aware of, I was listening to the author talk not a while back, and also just it was so clear in the book that even though she did enormous amounts of research on Margaret Mead and the place and the time, it was very sparely used.
Okay.
And I think that was, you know, so you have to hold back a lot, even though sometimes it's very difficult. I think you just have to be very aware of how you're using all of this wealth of information, you know.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Sharon, I want to just mention Sharon Guskin. The novel is The Forgetting Time, published by Flatiron Books. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. It was great to talk to you.
That, again, was a conversation with Sharon Guskin, whose novel is The Forgetting Time. The novel comes out tomorrow from Flatiron Books, and you can learn more about her work at her website, theforgettingtime.com. And actually, during our interview, just to remind you, she mentioned that you can email her from her website and send any stories that you might have about the sense or memory or experience of a past life. This week's Write the Book prompt was kindly suggested by my guest, Sharon Guskin. It's a four-part prompt that has to do with discovering your enthusiasm. First, as quickly as you can and without thinking about it ahead of time, list five areas that you feel are the neglected, dark corners of your world. The areas that aren't discussed enough or maybe need a little more air. Things that have to do with your own daily life or maybe a larger world that you want to write about. Then look at that list of five areas and circle the one that seems the most alive to you right now. Then imagine a voice within that world. And finally, again, without overthinking it, write from that voice for 20 minutes. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Advanced Music, a full-line music shop offering instruments and gear, audio, video design and installation, and electronic and stringed instrument repair services. You're local, we're local. Advance, it's been all about the music for more than 30 years. Advance Music is located at 75 Maple Street in Burlington and online at advancemusicvt.com. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. And finally, by the Vermont Developmental Disabilities Council. Let me say that again. The Vermont Developmental Disabilities Council, a board led by individuals and family members that focuses on bringing Vermonters with developmental disabilities into the heart of our communities. For more about the VDDC and becoming a member, visit ddc.vermont.gov or 888-317-2006. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary Miller's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then finally, please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.